This week, the Federal Reserve surprised some people by announcing it would continue its bond-buying stimulus program for at least another month. We'll be talking about what all this could mean for you on this personal finance edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and financial experts Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler will discuss what the Fed's decision to continue their year-old stimulus program says about the economy, how traders are reacting, and what it all might mean for your own finances. Also, is investing in bonds a good idea right now with interest rates rising? We welcome your personal finance questions today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is our monthly show devoted to personal finance. And Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler are here to answer your questions. Kevin Wasby is a chartered financial analyst. He's a lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business. Jake Keebler is a certified financial planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. And they both welcome your financial questions at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And welcome to the program.
Good morning, Jim, and thank you. Welcome to I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
And the big news this week seems to have been the Federal Reserve's announcement that they would be keeping their year-old economic stimulus practices. This is the bond buying that they had been doing in place at least for a while. And that was on Wednesday, I think, when they said that. And that was also the day that Wall Street trading hit another record, I think. Was that the second time this year that that a record was broken?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. And then market apparently pulled back a bit on Thursday. But I gathered that the announcement by the Fed that it would not be tapering just yet, and that's a phrase that I just learned yesterday, came as a surprise to a lot of investors, and with some analysts even saying that the Fed made a mistake, while others were saying no, what they had been doing before was a mistake, and now they were just correcting themselves. So, Kevin, what just happened here? Did the Fed send mixed messages on what it was going to do, and what is it going to do anyway?
Well, I think that's certainly the question of the day. It's continued even into today's press. The front page of the Wall Street Journal carries another article about the decision made, the announcement given Wednesday, and whether or not the Fed's attempts to be more open, more transparent, more efficient in communicating what their intentions are is really working out.
The headline is Fed's guidance questioned as market misreads signals.
Right. So, again, the discussions go on. Is the Fed being more open and transparent, and are people interpreting what is being said as what the actual implications of Fed policy mean?
And I would add to that that I think that the thing that I found very interesting about this announcement was how the market reacted. And I think that goes back to investors are constantly trying to anticipate what future factors are going to lead to future gains or losses. And so a lot of investor expectations about what the Fed would do had already been priced into the market. And their expectation was that the Fed would begin tapering off their program, which would lead to an increase in interest rates. When that did not happen, what we saw was bond prices jumped as interest rates, instead of rising as they expected, maybe held flat or even decreased a little bit.
The decision by the Fed to keep on, you know, the stimulus practices, but that it still might happen sometime in the future. We assume it'll happen sometime in the future. Does this mean that the stimulus practices are working in the eyes of the Fed, and they want to continue them? That they still need more? Or that they're not working well enough and they have to continue them because they haven't worked yet? Or what exactly has the Fed been doing, and what has the impact been on the markets?
Those are great questions, Jim, and I think it gets to the heart of some of the misunderstanding or volatility that comes about. Basically, just to step back, on September 13, 2012, the Federal Reserve announced the policy that's currently the policy at hand. That is, every month they purchase $40 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities and $45 billion worth of long-term treasury bonds. They're doing this in an attempt to drive interest rates at the longer-term structure of the interest rate relationships lower. Lower interest rates, obviously, if we thought about individuals, from the point of view of a person with a mortgage, if they're able to refinance their mortgage at a lower interest rate, reducing their monthly payments is thought to have a benefit from their ability to consume and, have a stimulative effect on the economy. Just one simpler, very superficial thought, but that's the type of, hope behind what the strategy was when it was implemented a year ago. In May this year, there was an announcement that led people to believe that the Fed would begin sometime in the fall, and the guess was around September, that they would begin scaling back on those purchases. And then, of course, the reaction to that was, if they are buying less bonds every month, they are, stepping back from a very accommodative policy. Buying fewer bonds means prices fall. If prices of bonds fall, interest rates rise. If interest rates rise, does that mean that the stimulative effect to the overall economic activity subsides? All of those things. And now I'll try to boil it down into what that means. For the individual investor, it's a great thing to be discussing from a policy point of view. It's timely. It's exciting news. If it gets you interested in how the economy works, that's cool. It's great. From what it means for your personal actions and activities in your portfolio, I really don't think it means much at all.
I think the one thing it may affect are those few holdouts in people who do have high interest rate mortgages and for whatever reason have not yet refinanced. This may be their final opportunity to lock in at a lower rate.
Agree with that. And we definitely saw that occur in June when this announcement came out. Mortgage rates at that time were at all-time lows, roughly 3 5/8%, so 3.625, I believe, was the low on a conventional 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. And over the course of the next 4 weeks, literally 4 weeks' time, those rates rose to as high as what I was seeing quotes at 4 5/8, 4 7/8, so more than a percentage point. Jake puts a good thought out there. For an individual that can refinance a mortgage at a lower rate than it's presently in it, that's the signal. And many people did that. The refinancing of mortgages has been one of the activities at banks that's been, very stimulated because of this low interest rate policy. It's been a part of bank earnings. But when those rates jumped up in 4 weeks, that activity basically came to a halt.
Now, that actually seems to touch on something I saw happening over the summer with real estate sales. And I know the Champaign County Champaign County Association of Realtors announced that after about, 15 months of straight increases compared to the same month last year, that real estate existing home sales in the county went down in August, I believe. And Todd Salen, the president of the association, says that he believed that was due to essentially people holding off to see what were going to happen to interest rates. And he thought that since there didn't seem to be much happening with interest rates, and because pending sales reported that same month seemed to be back up, that that he thought it was just a momentary lull trying to see what's happening. And now that the Fed is holding off at least another month, that seems to be, you're seeing more opportunity to do that sort of refinancing for a lower rate, but they could still do something in October. They could still decide to taper then. Would that be a reasonable expectation, or at least a possible expectation?
I think that's a reasonable expectation. I mean, there's a lot of moving pieces in the puzzle here, and I would defer to a person like Todd Salen when it comes to a real estate transaction. For instance, when a person is buying a house and getting a mortgage commitment from a lender, there is a lock-in time period. They can lock in an interest rate for a given period of time that shelters them from day-to-day moves in interest rates. So there's going to be kind of a lead lag effect when we see that working through into either pending sales, applications for purchases, or actually funded committed mortgages. But all that aside, I don't think there's any doubt that a purchase decision that involves a large amount of dollars and a large amount of dollars that are borrowed is a decision that is very influenced, affected by the level of interest rates.
If the Fed eventually decides to taper, to pull back on the stimulus efforts it's been making, is that something that that someone as an investor should pay attention to when that comes?
Well, I think I would go back to Kevin's statement in that will it affect an individual on a day-to-day basis? Probably not so much. You'll definitely see in the market some short-term reactions. Probably see rising interest rates, which will actually affect bond prices. So short-term, you will see some volatility in the bond market. You'll probably see interest rates on mortgages also going up, which may have some effect on the housing market. But I think if you take a step back and think about, well, what is the implication? Why is the Fed making these decisions? The Fed is looking at the economy as a whole. And so if the Fed is pulling back on their program, that would indicate that the economy is getting stronger, which is certainly good news. So even though there may be some short-term lulls in housing sales, I would think long-term, if the economy is improving, then home sales would also increase.
And if they're not pulling back quite yet, that suggests that the economy as a whole isn't quite back on even keel yet either.
Well, that you could interpret that would be their view of the market. And I think that's where some of the controversy has been, is that we're seeing record highs in the stock market, and at the same time, the Fed is saying, well, the economy's not really that strong. So I think one of the things that we can take away from this is that the stock market is one of the indicators of economic strength, but it is not the only indicator.
Jake brings up a great point. Like every coin, there are two sides. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about the impact to things like mortgage activity or house sales or refinancing. On the other side of the coin, if interest rates what I would say is rise to more normal levels, the benefit comes to those people that are the savers and are the investors who literally have been penalized for a number of years now with extremely low and artificially low, in my opinion, interest rates. For example, we all know that if you have a certificate of deposit at a bank, the interest rate that you see on the renewal notice or on the actual document itself right now, even though you may have become sensitized to it in a longer run framework, is hideously low. So there is an upside to higher interest rates if the economy can sustain a growth path with those higher rates. Savers have been subsidizing the stimulus to the economy.
Okay. Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with the personal finance experts today, Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler. Call us with your comments and questions at 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Again, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-WILL, and you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. This action or non-action by the Fed this week sent the stock market to a new record level, and it had already hit a record level earlier this year. And when I was looking at a chart showing the market's progress, 2013 seemed to be a much better year than years before as we came out of the recession. Has the market really been making a strong recovery overall this year? Is this the year that things are back?
Well, on balance, this year has certainly been a good one for stocks. There's no question of that. And really, it began in January, picked up steam in February. The only, I would say, real pause came around the time in June when the first hints of scaling back on this stimulus program came to light. But again, as you pointed out, the Dow Industrial Average, the Standard & Poor's 500 Composite Index, and a handful of other stock market indicators set all-time new highs on Wednesday, just literally hours after the announcement.
What's it been doing since then? Has it dropped back down, or is it
the past couple of days have been, profit-taking, little ebbs back, a 24-point loss on the Dow yesterday. Right now, I think the Dow is down 18 to 20 points today. But again, these are just noise items. I mean, day-to-day prices for a person who calls themselves an investor are really irrelevant.
So if you're not making daily or weekly decisions about your market investments, it's not something you're looking at.
If you're not a trader, you don't even want to look at these things.
But overall, it sounds like there's more value in the market in 2013 than, say, 2011.
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing some very healthy rates of return. If a person wanted to look just as a way to kind of get a glimpse of these, the Dave Sinnoh Couch Potato Portfolio up on Will's website is a good way to do it. And they'll notice that most of those funds that put that couch potato together, that portfolio together, are index funds that track very broad sections of the stock market.
And we're going to get the latest version of that couch potato portfolio on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus as soon as possible. I'm looking at the couch potato portfolio. You had it be the latest version. I'm looking at the one from 2 months ago, and they're all numbers to me, but I noticed that the percentage return, which was 15.54 2 months ago, is now 18.85. I assume that's good.
Well, if you're invested in those assets, that is a happy story.
Okay. We will try to get that to you on our website as soon as possible so you could see this least effort possible version of investing, at least one person's version of it, at will.illinois.edu/focus. Jake, in the meantime, are people asking you about the market just in terms of how it's been doing this year? And, you know, is there something they should be doing? Or especially someone who isn't in right now, is this a good time to be in?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, Jim. I would say in general, our clients, we have pretty well trained about what the difference is between long-term investing and short-term speculating. And so we tend not to get too many questions about short-term movements in the market. That's not to say that there isn't a lot of questions out there about what is the right thing to be doing in the market right now. And I really think that question goes back to a strategy of trying to predict market changes. So for those people who like to take an active strategy of investing, meaning that they're trying to make predictions about future market changes, there are a lot of questions about, are bonds a good investment right now? And this actually goes back to the question of interest rates and Fed policy and the overall economy, in that when interest rates rise, bond prices will fall. Those relationships have an inverse relationship. So as bond prices decrease, interest rates tend to increase and vice versa. So,
and interest rates are rising?
Well, they have been over the past few months. What we've seen with this announcement are interest rates actually did fall just slightly over the past couple of days, although really a couple of days is not too much of an indication.
You need to look at if you're looking at something fairly long term, what period of time do you want to be focused on?
Well, it probably would go back to time horizon in terms of what's your investment time horizon. In terms of monitoring market performance, I tend to take a a long-term approach of let's see how your portfolio has done over, let's say, the past year. But in terms of investing, you know, what I would consider an investor in the market, definitely no less than 1 year, but really 3 to 5 years before you can consider yourself an investor versus a saver.
Let's go ahead and take a call. This is Walter who's calling from his car. Good morning, Walter. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I had a question about the Fed dumping $40 billion worth of money into the economy every month. Since there's nothing back in the U.S. dollar anymore, like silver certificates or gold, does this dilute our purchasing power?
That's a good question. Actually, they're not dumping that money into the economy, so let me try to get a little bit focused on the technicals of it. They're actually making market purchases of $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities. Those are long-term investment vehicles that are portfolios of mortgages packaged together as pass-through certificates. And then they're also buying $45 billion a month of longer-term outstanding Treasury notes and bonds. In doing so, they're not dumping money into the economy, quote-unquote. So what they're actually doing is they're buying an asset that's in the outstanding marketplace from somebody that owns it. Now, who is that somebody? It might be an institutional investor that holds it on behalf of you and thousands of other investors in that pooled investment, that fund. It might be a bank that holds some of those securities on their own balance sheet because banks have basically two types of assets. One is loans, the other are bonds. It might be you or I who decide that, you know, we're going to sell the U.S. Treasury note that matures in 3 years that we happen to own. We bought it 2 years ago when it was a five-year note. And the market price has gotten to the point where we just say, my goodness, I'm going to take my money and go elsewhere. So dumping it into the economy is really not a good way to state it. It is pushing liquidity into a secondary market for these instruments.
Maybe I stated my question improperly. I guess what I was thinking is that if you have stock, if you have a million shares of stock available and it's selling at $30 a share, and then you double that and you drop it down to $15 a share, is that a comparable situation when they just print money and put it into the and purchase things, mortgage-backed securities or whatever?
No. The example you gave about the stock is really a two-for-one stock split, which effectively means nothing to the value of the firm nor to your individual holdings of the value of the firm. But the point I want to make about the Fed policy is they are really not printing money, quote-unquote. I mean, if we could imagine something like dollar bills coming off sheets of paper out of a mechanical printing press and so on and so forth, that's really not what's happening.
I see.
I would say that there are a lot of people that are concerned that current Fed policy could lead to future inflation. And I certainly am not one that tries to predict the future. You know, I certainly want to understand the factors behind what future changes may happen. But in terms of do I know the directionality of that, I can guarantee it'll either go up or down, but I don't know which way.
Is there a balancing act involved here on the part of the Federal Reserve in taking an action like this, that they're trying to do something to stimulate the economy, but if they're not careful, they could also stimulate inflation?
Yes.
I think
I think that hits to the caller's question. If I could just key on that right now and maybe get to the caller's question more succinctly. What these policies are doing is increasing the supply of lendable funds. Okay, so if a person were to look at banks' balance sheets, you would see the amount of reserves, lendable money, lendable. So it's there and could become loans. The impetus behind this plan is to increase that lendable supply of funds. But a loan requires two things: not only the availability of money to be borrowed, but the demand for that money in a context that is an agreeable transaction. So what the Fed has been stimulating is the supply of lendable funds, but what they don't really have a lot of control over is the demand for it. And I think that kind of gets to the debate of, well, how effective has the policy been and what does it mean and what are the actions that work through it? But again, back to the caller's original point, this is not printing money and dropping it from a helicopter or any such thing. It's increasing the supply of lendable funds. The demand for those funds has still not picked up, but as Jake points out, if and when the demand picks up and this huge supply of lendable funds becomes new loans created in the economy, that is what drives the supply of money in circulation higher. That is what has the potential to drive rates of inflation higher. That is what also has the potential to drive the value of the U.S. dollar versus the British pound versus the euro currency or whatever lower.
And I think an example may clarify a little bit. If you were looking at a business who was thinking about making an investment in new technology or increasing their labor force, the way that they're going to analyze that proposition is, if I make this investment, will it return me more than it costs me to make this investment? So when there's more funds available for lending, their cost of borrowing decreases, which makes projects of investments look more attractive. And at the moment, we're still seeing a fairly high rate of unemployment. So that would seem to indicate that if they make this investment, that there's going to be available labor to step in and grow the business. So when we get to the point where unemployment starts falling, then we may see some danger of inflation. But I think the Fed is taking the position right now that until we lower unemployment, we're not in any danger of increasing costs.
I guess there is a question, and maybe, Walter, this is what you were wondering. These tens of billions of dollars which the Fed is using in its stimulus program, are those assets that were already documented in the Fed's own reserves, or were they just created somehow?
Yeah, that's basically it, yes.
They are created.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the thing that some people that people have problems with. If you're creating assets, should they be backed up by something? What will work as a sufficient guarantee of the full faith and credit?
And that's a great discussion we could have on the actual Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The Fed is celebrating its 100th birthday this year. and I mean, seriously, we're all laughing about it, but that would be a lovely, you know, kind of theme to have an adult beverage over.
Yeah.
And a little cake, yes. Walter, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
And let me go to line two, Jeff in Champaign. I think, good morning, you're on the air. I think you also had a question on the Fed.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up on Walter's question here. The Fed is buying all of these documents, and they're on their books. Well, ultimately, they have to sell them, and if the interest rates go up, then their value is going to go down, so they're going to take a big loss on all these documents. Is that something then the Treasury just has to support? Is that the deal? I mean, it seemed to me, you know, I understand they're pushing interest rates down, but when interest rates go up, all these assets that they're buying are going to be worth substantially less than what they paid for them.
That is correct.
Yeah. So
that does assume, though, that the Fed would actually sell them. The current policy is that they are not selling. The current policy is that all of the interest income they're receiving and any normal maturities are actually being reinvested in new purchases. I understand what you're saying, and it's a valid point. When interest rates rise, the value of those securities will fall. If the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve has close to $3 trillion worth, the potential to have a unrealized loss is huge. So Here's the way I think about it. Last year, like most years prior, the Federal Reserve reports, here are the numbers of dollars of income slash profits, call it revenues less our own expenses, that we turned over to the U.S. Treasury. So what's at risk? Yeah, are they going to bill the Treasury for any losses? No, they're not. They're probably running a risk of turning over few dollars of profits to the Treasury. But again, that's I wouldn't call that a significant component of our federal receipts.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you. We're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be back with more talk about personal finance with Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler. We'll be taking your calls at 1-800-222-9455. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back with a personal finance edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler are here with financial advice for you. Kevin's a chartered financial analyst. Jake is a certified financial planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. And we're inviting you to call now with your personal finance questions at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. You know, my producer passed along a question, just wondering for people who are just starting out, but when I thought about it, it could be anybody who's maybe just managed to scrape together a certain amount of money that they want to do more than just sit in a savings account at the current low interest rates. What are some ways you could or should go about investing a few thousand dollars? What sort of risk level should you go for under what circumstances? What sort of options are out there?
So if I understand the question, this would be a younger person who's just started to accumulate cash and is wondering the best use at that stage of life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I certainly see the temptation of looking at the market and saying, you know, my current savings account is earning 0.1% or 0.2%, or maybe if you're really lucky and using one of the online banks, maybe you're earning 0.6% or 0.8%. And then looking at the stock market and then saying, oh, well, you know, the returns over the past year have been 10%, 12%, 15%, and saying maybe I should be putting my money there. If this was a younger person, my first point of caution would be, you know, emergency funds are a very important component of a personal financial plan. And so if you look at the opportunity cost of your emergency funds against the stock market, certainly the stock market looks very attractive right now. But on the flip side, an emergency fund has the ability to save you in other ways. For instance, imagine this: the scenario of a car breaking down or an unexpected emergency where you need to travel. And if you were to put that on your credit card, as opposed to having funds to back that up and cover it from your savings, you know, you may be paying out 20 or 25%. So I would first make the argument of, before you look at investing, can you really afford to take on that risk at the point of life that you're in?
And that's the question, and maybe it's different at different stages in life. How much money is it a good idea to have available if you can, and liquid, and somebody you can draw on it right away?
Mm-hmm. The standard advice is about 3 to 6 months of living expenses. In all practicality, for most people live, paycheck to paycheck. So 3 to 6 months of income is really the ideal target. But for someone who tends to be a saver, and if they lost income, would not need to replace their full paycheck, you could really look at, what does it cost me to live? And multiply that by a factor of 3 to 6 months.
Okay, so keep that, and then once you get beyond that amount, then maybe you can look at some more long-term savings with the extra.
Exactly.
And I think Jake hits the nail square on the head. A part of this is involved with a financial plan, and that financial plan becomes one that's implemented month after month after month after month. So basic budgeting decisions. So obviously, if the person has a few thousand dollars they're wondering what to do with, one would assume they have that money because they spent less than they made. That's a great first step. And the next step that would come right in line with that should be some type of strategy that has a good portfolio understanding and mix that's appropriate to every month additions. So, again, just basic budgeting decisions. Can I afford to be putting money into my emergency account every month? And once I've accomplished that, can I then put money away every month for my longer-term needs, which might include risky assets that we would call investments?
Okay. Let me. We're starting to get some phone calls, so I'm going to go to one of them. And on line four, George in Decatur, good morning. I understand you have another question going back to the Fed's actions this week.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the idea, is the Fed buying the mortgage-backed securities at fire sale price, fair value? And the question drives to the issue of, on the balance sheet of the Fed, they have all these mortgage-backed securities. Don't they have the risk that we originally had that they will default? And the next question is this not a method of bailing out the banks by buying their bad paper?
Well, I think on the mortgage-backed securities, it's more than just looking at it from the bank's perspective. One of the reasons why they're interested in the mortgage-backed securities specifically is that our public policy, and this is not just the Fed, but this is Congress and this is a lot of lobbying, is that the belief that home ownership is a very fundamental part of, you know, the American dream. And so it's the belief that by holding mortgage rates low that we can encourage home ownership, which will lead to future financial stability and even maybe some profitability for the individual American. You know, if you look at our mortgage system as compared to other countries, you know, we have a very unique system. The fact that you can take out a 30-year mortgage, which from the bank's perspective is a fairly risky investment, and as an individual, the interest rates that we're seeing on a mortgage are sometimes lower than some of the biggest corporations would pay if they were to borrow money over a 30-year time frame.
And to go to one of the other elements of the caller's question, the securities they're buying, they are paying fair market value for. So I've just pulled up an announcement from yesterday. The Fed bought a total of $3.29 billion worth of Treasury notes, and there were a total of $9.916 billion submitted in this process that you and I would, look at and call an auction. People that own them were offering them for sale, and the Fed bid on these variety of securities at a price that cleared the market. As it goes to the mortgage-backed securities they're buying, the mortgage-backed securities are agency mortgage-backed securities. You, the taxpayer, have already assumed the default risk on those individual mortgages already, because when the agencies bought them, packaged them, and created the pass-through certificates, they guaranteed the prompt payment of interest and principal.
And I, George, does that answer your questions?
Well, it begs the question. Are you saying that the U.S. government is guaranteeing Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae bonds or mortgage-backed securities?
Yes.
Okay. That's an interesting observation.
Okay.
That answers my question.
Okay, George. Well, thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Susan in Urbana on line one. A question, I understand, about leveraging giving. Good morning, Susan.
Hi. Actually, it's not a question. It's a comment.
Okay.
I lend on a crowd lending website called Kiva.org, and I don't get any interest back on what I lend. But I have a choice of loans, microloans in 67 countries, including the U.S., and I've been doing this now for almost 7 years. And once in a while, somebody defaults on their little loan, but I only lend $25 to the bigger package for a loan for someone. So someone might need $560 or several thousand dollars, and there are oodles of lenders who get together and put in their $25 or $50 on a particular loan. But in the time that I've been doing it, the repayments have recycled so that my individual dollar, even though I've added more money over time, my individual dollars have done the work of $5. So that's a pretty good return on, you might say, on my philanthropy dollar. I also give to WYLL, which I think I don't get a financial return on that, but I get a knowledge return on that and other things like that. But this is kind of unusual because you're helping people help their own lives in ways that they think will better themselves. And I think it's pretty cool. It's also very fun, and I get to learn. It's almost like I get to travel in other parts of the world, and I get to talk to other lenders on the website if I want to. So I just wanted to mention that there are other additional ways to think about feeling rich. And you don't. And how many of us waste $25 each month on diddly stuff that we could easily come up with? So anyway, that's my contribution to the conversation today.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. This is Jake. I actually am familiar with the Kiva concept in microfinance and assisting third world countries. And I really liked your point about using sites, nonprofit organizations like Kiva to feel wealthy, because I think it's an economist who said that the ultimate sign of wealth is the ability to help others. And I think that this is one great organization that you can do that through.
Okay, Susan, thank you very much. There is something that comes to mind. If you're lending money like this, this is a form of philanthropy, but I don't know if this is something that you can claim a tax deduction on.
That's a good question. I don't believe that the Kiva organization, it would go back to their tax status with the IRS and whether they're considered a 501(c), which is the designation you need in order to receive a tax deduction.
Okay. We still have time for your questions about personal finance. Questions for Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler. Our phone number, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Kevin, I think it was you that was passing along the index cards worth of all the financial investment advice you'll ever need. And I forget, was it you, Kevin, noting this isn't really necessarily about investing, maybe all the other things should take care of in your financial life besides, getting on the market and playing there.
Yeah, it was something passed along to me by a person in our department. It was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I brought it along today because it does bring out what I think is a very true statement, and that is we don't need to overcomplicate this. So just as a for instance, the things that are on a 3x5 index card or 4x6 index card profess to be all you'll need to know on investment advice or financial advice, actually. Stuff like max your 401k or equivalent employer retirement plan. Never buy or sell an individual security. The other side of the table knows more about it than you do. Save 20% of your money. I mean, these are all just great keep it simple type of maxims, if you want to look at it that way. But I think in a very serious vein, it brings about what is so often true. So often we get caught up in the minutiae that really doesn't matter in the long run, and we lose sight of the simple principles and good common sense that over the long run make the difference between whether we have good financial success or not.
We're going to try to get a link to one of the versions of that financial investment advice index card onto our website at will-illinois.edu/focus. One place you can find it, if you go to the lifehacker.com website and search around there, it was added there recently. On line four, Jim in Kankakee has a question about keeping things simple. I think, Jim, you're on the air. Did you have a question about the couch potato fund?
Jim, are you with us?
Relatively actively managing the fund to the extent of determining whether or not the allocations among the various funds are still valid, and how often should I attempt to rebalance that fund? Thank you.
I didn't hear the front part of your question. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. We had a little cutoff at the beginning. Could you repeat the beginning of the question, Jim?
Sure. Who, if anyone, is tending the couch potato portfolio to determine whether or not the allocations need to be changed?
No one's actually tending it. That was part of the reason why it was called couch potato. That portfolio was just a suggested way to allocate whatever equity exposure a person wanted in their total portfolio. And the name Couch Potato was given to it, I believe, by David Sino, who basically set it up as a, I won't call it set and forget, but I would call it something that you don't need to tinker with. The question you've asked, though, is a very valid one. So let's pretend that you followed this prescription of eight funds in these proportions for the percentage of your wealth you're investing in equities. Rebalancing becomes a very important issue. So in other words, compared to the fixed income element or other components of your total portfolio, if this equity section gets to be significantly different from your target, the issue of rebalancing gets to be very valid. My personal opinion is I look at my total portfolio once a year and rebalance once a year.
So what, that's just it, once a year. You can do it on New Year's Eve and then enjoy an adult beverage. So.
Right. There is a lot of academic studies that have gone on in terms of what is the optimal time for rebalancing. You know, is it a fixed time frame? Is it a banded method where you're looking at you should rebalance if the portfolio exceeds some set parameter? And from what we've seen, when you take into account trading costs in terms of if you have any expenses in terms of buying and selling, as well as taking into account any tax implications. And also you want to keep in mind that the markets can be volatile, and so you don't want to be rebalancing daily just because of market swings. So I would agree with Kevin, anywhere from 1 to 2 times a year is pretty much the optimal time frame for most people.
Jim, does that answer your questions as far as the couch potato fund is concerned?
Yes, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Jim. And that sounds actually, if you're talking about once or twice a year, that's couch potato enough for a lot of people. They would get off the couch eventually anyway.
Mm-hmm. It should seem to be doable by most people.
And that we're going back. I'm going back to the financial investment advice index cards. You know, one of the things down on the list is pay attention to fees. Avoid actively managed funds. So when we're talking about investment funds, are we also talking about things that the homework's already been done? They don't have to, besides the fee expenses, it should be balanced enough so they don't have to keep on tweaking it every week.
Right. The active funds is indicating that when you purchase things like a mutual fund, you're buying into a basket of investments. And there's really two strategies in terms of investing by that mutual fund. There's either an active strategy where there is a manager or team of managers trying to select securities for their portfolio that they believe are going to outperform some benchmark. And then you can look at that and compare that to an index fund, which is really designed to track and replicate the performance of some segment of the market. And just inherently actively managed funds tend to be more expensive because you have to cover the costs of investing, the cost of the research, plus the managers tend to make a pretty decent salary for their work. So just comparing the active versus the index fund, the actively managed fund not only has to outperform their benchmark, but they also need to make up through returns however much the additional cost of investing in an actively managed fund is. So to give you an example, I believe right now the average actively managed mutual fund, you'd probably expect to pay 1 to 1.25% per year in management fees. Comparing that to an index fund, the costs have continually been driven down, with something like a Vanguard index fund, you might be looking at 1 or 2/10 of a percent. So, you know, that's a 1% difference per year, which can, in the long term, have a fairly significant effect on your long-term expected returns.
Okay. That is all the time we have today on Focus. Thank you for all your calls seeking personal financial advice from Kevin Waspy, Chartered Financial Analyst, and Jake Keebler, Certified Planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Focus today.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
And we'll be getting a link over to that Financial Investment Advice Index card. It is, by the way, the creation of University of Chicago professor Harold Pollack. And we'll try to get the latest couch potato portfolio numbers on our website very soon at will.illinois.edu/focus. That's also where you can go with any other additional thoughts you have about today's program. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Monday on Focus, our guest is media designer Ann Balsamo, who says that while new media are shaping the way we organize and think about things, we can play a role in shaping the new media while keeping our eye on the type of society we want to live in. That's coming up on Monday's program. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. archived at our website, will.illinois.edu. This is Focus on WILL.